This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Thank you all for coming today. I know we're here in unceded First Nations territory in what's called Canada, but most of my public presentations over the last 3 weeks have been in the United States. So I'm going to be a little U.S.-centric, but I hope you can hang because I'm sure that you're able to understand the relevance for yourselves as well. So I'd like you to imagine a North America slightly different from the one that exists today. In this North America, the director of the largest hospital in Philadelphia laments that Jews are having babies and forbids Jews from entering the hospital unless it's an emergency. In this America, in Palm Beach County, the pastor at the largest church organizes chief pastors around the country, hundreds of them, to issue a religious edict forbidding Christians from selling or even renting apartments to Jews. City Councilor Philadelphia proposes separate bus lines for Jews because they smell bad and they spread diseases. President of the City Council of Brooklyn kicks Jews out of their apartments in the middle of the winter. Mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, orders police to round up all the Jews in town, stick them on buses, and drive them straight out of town. Mayor of Sacramento forces all the Jews in town into just one separate sector of the city. Mayor of Los Angeles puts red flags about the town and announces that now the Jews constitute 10% of the population, that the city is at war with them. The chief of the Department of Homeland Security says, why can't Jews accept that America belongs to the white Christian man, and vows that he will make the Jews' lives miserable until they leave. And Attorney General Eric Holder passes new regulations which allow Jews to be rounded up, arrested, and jailed for even the smallest crimes without even granting them the right to a fair trial to defend themselves in a court of law. Now, of course, everything I've just told you is completely fictitious, doesn't exist, and hopefully it never will exist. But that is exactly the situation in Israel today, not towards Jews, but towards Africans. So not in Philadelphia, but its sister city of Tel Aviv, the director of the largest hospital, Ichilov Hospital, lamented that Africans were having babies and forbade Africans from entering unless it's an emergency. Not in Palm Beach County, but its sister city of Tzfat, where the chief rabbi organized chief rabbis around the entire country to issue a religious edict forbidding Jews from renting or selling apartments to non-Jews, general and Africans specifically. Not Philadelphia, but again, sister city of Tel Aviv, where a city councilor proposed separate bus lines for Africans because they smell bad and they spread diseases. And not in Brooklyn, but the sister city of Bnei Brak, where the mayor kicked Africans out of their apartments in the middle of the winter. And not Charlotte, but a sister city of Khedera, where the mayor ordered police to round all the Africans up and drive them out of town in the middle of the night. And not Sacramento, but Ashkelon, where the mayor forced Africans to live in only one separate section of the city. And not LA, but in Eilat, sister city, where the mayor put red flags about the town and said that now that Africans are 10% of the population, that the city is at war with them. And not the Department of Homeland Security, but its Israeli equivalent, the Ministry of the Interior, who said, why can't Africans accept that Israel belongs to the white man, and vowed to make their lives miserable until they leave. And not the Attorney General of the U.S., Eric Holder, but the Attorney General of Israel, Yehuda Weinstein, who instituted practices to arrest and jail Africans for any suspicion of a crime without even giving them the right to a fair trial. And this isn't theoretical. This happens on the daily. To understand how far back you would have to go in American history to reach a similar state of affairs, you would actually have to return to 1850, which is when Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, under which any white person just had to accuse a black man or woman of being his or her slave. Police would be required to arrest them on sight, take them down to the South. They had no right to appeal, to take it to a court to defend themselves. I'll give you an example of how this plays out so you can understand. So let's say you're an African man or woman and you're riding your bike down the street, Tel Aviv. Cop will stop you. Say, is that your bike? You say, of course, that's my bike. Well, can you prove it? What do you mean by that? It's my bike. Well, do you have a receipt for it? Can you prove that you paid for it? No, I bought this bike 8 months ago. I don't carry around receipts 8 months. Well, I'm sorry. You are under suspicion of stealing this bicycle. You're coming with me to jail. You're off to jail. No appeal. That's the situation. Now, I'm not talking about the Africans that Israel airlifted to the country in the late 80s and 90s. I'm not talking about the Africans that serve in the Israeli army, or the Africans that serve in the Israeli Knesset, or the Africans that win beauty pageants. Okay? I'm not talking about African Jews, or Jewish Africans, or Ethiopian Israelis, as they're often called. Of course, Jewish people of color experience racism in Israel. There's white supremacy there as much as there is here. And there, as here, people with less pigment often feel that they deserve more privileges than people who have more pigment. White supremacy and also nativism is a problem there, as here. So people who immigrated less recently often believe they deserve more privileges than people who immigrated more recently. And of course, classism is also a huge issue, where people who have amassed more stuff believe that they deserve more privileges than people who have amassed less stuff. But on top of all of these layers of oppression, there's Jewish supremacy, where people who are Jewish or more Jewish, however you would define that, often believe that they are due more privileges than those people who are not Jewish or people who are less Jewish. So I'll explain how this plays out, all these systems of oppression on top of one another. So this is a tract that was written about Tel Aviv, published in Haaretz newspaper where I used to report and edit. I'll read it to you. In the corners of the living quarters of the Africans, you will find the filth, card games played for money, residents getting drunk, and prostitution. The Africans bring this way of life with them when they migrate. And it's no wonder the crime in the country is on the upswing. Young women and even young men are again not safe going out in the streets alone after dark. Now, this text could very easily have been written last week or last month about African asylum seekers, but it was actually written in 1949. It wasn't written about these Africans who've only just recently immigrated to the country. It was written about these Africans, Jews from Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Mizrahi Jews who immigrated to Israel in the late 1940s. The same kinds of racism was directed at them. So again, Jewish people of color also experience racism in Israel, but it pales in comparison, pun very much intended, it pales in comparison to the discrimination that non-Jewish people of color face. So who are these people then? Let's see, we're here in Turtle Island, otherwise known as North America, and here Israel, Palestine, and Northeast Africa. I'm gonna zoom in there, and these are the names of the countries presently. I'm going to take most of them away, just focus on the main actors here, zoom in. So 2000s, you have a large stream of Sudanese refugees heading towards Libya and from there onto Europe. But the European nations who wanted to reduce African immigration, they cut a deal with Gaddafi. They said, if you agree to police your maritime borders and prevent Africans from entering the European continent, then we'll purchase more oil from you. So they struck a deal, and after that, that migration route was cut off. And then you have Sudanese refugees heading towards Egypt, and a little while later, onto Israel. Soon after, Eritrean refugees also began following the same migration route. And so people ask me, well, why wouldn't these refugees just stay in Egypt? What was wrong there? Why did they have to continue on to Israel? Well, New Year's Eve 2006, Sudanese refugees in Egypt demanding their refugee rights, protesting in front of the United Nations offices in Cairo. Egyptian police come in and just beat and shoot and kill dozens of men, women, and children, Sudanese refugees. So at this point, no Sudanese refugee feels safe in Egypt. And that's when you have 2006, the beginning of the flight across the Sinai Desert towards Israel. And that's when you have the following year, in 2007, as I spoke earlier, the mayor of Khedera ordering police to round up all the Africans in town, stick them on a bus, and drop them off in some park the next town over. And remember, at this point, it's just a few dozen families. But even that was too much. And before you say, well, this must be some marginal phenomenon, you know, this is must be an extremist who did this, we'll recognize that this politician, the mayor of Khedera, openly embraced by Benjamin Netanyahu. They campaigned together in elections, and the following year, 2009, you have Benjamin Netanyahu running for Prime Minister of Israel, winning the election, becoming Prime Minister, and now these policies are brought in to the Prime Minister's office, taken to the national level. And the first thing that Netanyahu does when he's elected to power is he appoints as his interior minister that pivotal position that has a great deal of power over who enters the country and who isn't allowed entry into the country. And he appoints as his interior minister Eli Yishai, then the leader of the openly Jewish supremacist Shas party. This is where the spiritual leader of the Shas party announces that non-Jews were created by God in order to serve Jews. That's their sole purpose on the planet, according to the spiritual leader of the Shas party. And so this is what informs their policies. Now they've got their hand on the lever, deciding who enters and who doesn't. And so first thing they do is they take away from the United Nations the capacity to determine who's deserving of refugee status and who isn't, and they create their own infrastructure. And they brought in a man to do so, this man here, a man by the name of Joel Moss. And like me, Jewish man, also Canadian, he had for many years worked for the Canadian government in the capacity of determining refugee status, people who immigrated to Canada going over their case files. And because of his years of experience at this work, and because he, as an Orthodox Jew, he felt affinity for the state of Israel, wanted to contribute. He uprooted himself and moved across the Atlantic, moved to Israel, so that he could help create an Israeli infrastructure for dealing with what was the first wave of non-Jewish immigration to the country in its history. And so after he had done this, after the government brought him in and to set up this new asylum seeker infrastructure, this is what he had to say. "We, with the United Nations and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, we trained Israeli officers to the highest international standards. But the system is basically carved out to reject claims. The state is doing just about everything it can to not implement the spirit of the Geneva Convention. Instead of judging claims effectively, it's deterring refugees from coming or staying here." So the Africans themselves say, "We are refugees. We've fled political persecution and ethnic cleansing. And I probably don't have to tell you too much about Sudan. It's been enough in the news. You've heard of the genocides that have gone on there, the civil war." But in addition, a large majority of the African refugees in Israel are from Eritrea. You may not know, but just a little primer, it's one of the only countries in the world, if not the only country, that has actually never held an election in its entire history. So you can imagine what the human rights situation is like there. No free press. On the way to Israel, many of these African asylum seekers are kidnapped by human traffickers. And on mobile phones, they'll call up the relatives of the people they've kidnapped and torture them while they're on the phone with the relatives and issue these threats saying, "If you don't send large sums of money through these illicit channels, then we will continue to torture your sister, cousin." And you may want to look away because this is extremely disturbing. But in addition to the tortures you can probably imagine, the beatings and the rapes and the gang rapes and the executions, they've also developed this new innovative torture technique where they take plastic bags and they melt them. They drip them onto people's bodies, scarring them permanently. This has been documented by news channels from Al Jazeera to CNN and beyond. And another thing that people often come to me and say is, "Well, what about all these other countries? Why are you focusing on Israel? You know, why does it always happen to be Israel?" Well, that's actually far from the case. True, there's no perfect situation. Other countries are struggling, trying to balance their own needs of the demands of their citizens with their international obligations to provide safe haven and refuge for refugees. But if you look in the Middle East, in Israel's neighborhood, many other countries are stepping up and taking in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of refugees. And actually, these numbers from last year aren't even accurate anymore because Lebanon has since taken in millions more. So it's now way ahead, something like 25% of the population of Lebanon, Israel's northern neighbor, is now composed of refugees. So clearly other countries are stepping up and doing their part. What about Israel? Well, if you compare Israel to the countries it wishes to be aligned with and compared to, you have here Canadian government granting refugee status to full 96% of all Eritreans who apply for it. Other countries, some more, some less, Even in France, still over 50%, more than half of those applying receive it. In Israel, 0% of Eritreans receive refugee status. In fact, Israel actually leads the world. It has the lowest refugee acceptance rate of any country in the world. We're not singling Israel out. Israel is singling itself out. And if these people aren't refugees, then what are they? Well, according to the government of Israel, they're all liars. I guess all the truth tellers come to America and to Canada and to every other country, and all the liars migrate to Israel, according to the Israeli government. Propaganda, and they say that these people merely moved to Israel in order to make more money. They say these people are simply economic migrants who are trying to make a quick buck and then move back home and retire off of this, you know, this massive amount of money that they've made. You know, this is the line that the Israeli government is pitching. And so it creates an immigration police, and these officers patrol Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities, and they round people up and kick them out of the center of the country and into jails. And in addition to the police presence, and you've then got religious officials joining in on the act. And as I described earlier, first in Tel Aviv, dozens of rabbis, state-funded rabbis, signing these religious edicts, forbidding Jews from selling or even renting apartments to Africans specifically, and non-Jews in general. And then this idea just spreads like wildfire. And you have hundreds of chief rabbis throughout the country issuing these edicts, same edicts, forbidding Jews from renting to Africans. And probably the sickest part of all is when you look at the text in Hebrew, I mean, because how do they justify this religious edict? They go back to the Bible and they start quoting chapter verse from where? From tracts of the Bible that call for ethnic cleansing. So they say, because here in the Bible, it calls for us to ethnically cleanse the land of Israel of non-Jewish people. That's the reason you're forbidden for renting apartments to non-Jews. That's how sick it gets. And this isn't a free speech issue. I've got no problem on a personal level with people saying whatever they're thinking and feeling, no matter how repugnant, even if they're calling for, you know, outright racism. But this isn't free speech. This is my tax money that's going towards funding these chief rabbis. And as you can see, they make a pretty penny. You know, Israeli salaries are far lower than this, the median salary of the average Israeli. This is long dough. And these rabbis, with these salaries, they are inciting racism. And then you have, as I said earlier, the mayor of Eilat putting up red flags throughout the city and warning people, we are all defending our home. Residents of Eilat are putting an end to infiltration. This is the term that the government uses to demonize and dehumanize the Africans and to criminalize them in the minds of the Israeli people. They're no longer asylum seekers, they're infiltrators. And then you have rallies through the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities in Israel where often led by Knesset members and former Knesset members here, like Michael Ben-Ari, people marching through the streets in areas where there's large concentrations of Africans, screaming at them, yelling at them, get out of here, leave the country, you're rapists, you're murderers. And these are some still shots of these anti-African rallies that I've documented. You're welcome at your leisure to take a business card or go onto my website. It's just my name, davidsheen.com. You go there. I've filmed dozens of rallies like this, and you can see for yourselves, I've translated and subtitled what people are saying in Hebrew so you can get a sense of the hate, the visceral hate. But even sadder than this racial hatred from adults is when it comes from kids, and you hear little kids, yeah, daddy, we got to kick out all the N-word. There's nothing more bone-chilling than that. And if you listen to what people are saying, or you ask them straight up, what's the reason, you know, why do you want all the Africans gone? Why do you want to kick them all out of the country? What people often tell you is that, I don't want them marrying our daughters. You know, like this poster right here at one of these anti-African rallies. Bnot Israel le'am Israel. Jewish women for the Jewish people. In other words, get your hands off our women. In other words, all your vaginas belong to us. You know, this idea of anti-miscegenation, you know, trying to prevent mixed marriages. And the funny thing is, in Israel, it's not even possible. There's no way for anyone in Israel of different religious backgrounds to marry one another because marriage is totally controlled by the ultra-Orthodox rabbis who run the country, you know, who run the religious establishment. They do not permit any mixed religious marriages. So the amount of people doing so, whether, you know, moving, you know, going out of the country and getting a civil marriage there in some city hall and then moving back to Israel. The amount of people doing that are so small and marginal. But even those few numbers of people that are doing so, even that drives people mad. And so you have these rallies. In Ashkelon, it was actually a deputy mayor of the city who organized this anti-miscegenation rally. So you have people just incensed by the idea that the racial purity of Israel is being defiled by the African gene code or something. And so the government doesn't want Africans in the country, but at the same time, it's still afraid of outright deporting them because that would look horrible on its human rights record to send people back to the horrors they fled from. So on one hand, it won't provide them with any services like place to live or food stamps or whatever. But on the, you know, on the other hand, it won't allow them to work to provide all these things for themselves. Well, how are you going to eat? Where are you going to sleep if you can't work? The idea, as famously said by the interior minister, is we will make their lives miserable until they leave. The idea is that they'll self-deport. So how are people living? Often under the table, if they can find it, working in menial jobs, making less than minimum wage, often being exploited by their employers since they aren't protected by labor laws, living maybe 8-9 people to a room, or sleeping in some bomb shelter somewhere, or out in the streets, in the parks, even in the rain. And then on top of the top-down racism you have coming from political and religious officials, and the bottom-up racism you have from street-level grassroots racism, then you have civil society joining in. So you have soup kitchens from Tel Aviv down to Eilat forbidding Africans from entering. So the very services geared towards the weakest members of society. Here are the absolute weakest members of society, and they aren't allowed access to soup kitchens. And thankfully, of course, a group of Israelis, kind-hearted people, got together and started up like a Food Not Bombs type outdoor soup kitchen working out of a public park in South Tel Aviv that's become something of a community focus for African asylum seekers. So thankfully, there's someone picking up the slack. January 2012, that's when the government passes the anti-infiltration law, and it's on the basis of this law that all of the measures, the anti-African legal measures, follow, like the one I described earlier, where Africans can simply be rounded up, taken to jail, merely based on an accusation. And as you can see, it passed very easily, almost, you know, unopposed, without any serious opposition to speak of. And I should point out that it wasn't even a new law. It was actually an amendment to an old, old law from the 1950s, originally legislated to criminalize Palestinians. After the war, 47-48, many people fled their homes, fleeing the fighting, trying to save their lives. Once there was a cessation of violence, coming back to their homes and their communities and their villages and their fields and vineyards, and the Israeli government wanted none of them because it wanted as few as possible non-Jewish people in the country. And so it forbade people from returning, and this is the law that it passed in order to prevent their return, criminalizing them, calling them infiltrators. So this law, used to criminalize Palestinians, then resuscitated decades later, now to criminalize Africans fleeing for their lives. Of course, once this happens, I issue a report to the United Nations. I was asked by an African NGO in Israel to put together to document all of this state-sponsored racism, and I did so. And the UN responded by agreeing with my findings and stating that, you know, the government must strike down this law that criminalizes Africans and that it must condemn these statements, these racist statements by political and religious leaders. Of course, the government did no such thing, completely ignored it. And the following month, you have full-scale anti-African violent vigilante attacks. You have Israelis firebombing 6-7 African people's homes in a single night in Tel Aviv, even an African kindergarten, if you can imagine that. The next day, there were Jewish Israelis who came out in the streets and protested and were incensed by this sick racism and, you know, demanded an end to it and protection for the African asylum seekers. But for their troubles, these Israelis who stand in solidarity with Africans are hated even more than the Africans themselves, if that's possible. Completely marginalized, they are a tiny fraction of the population and despised for doing so. And the month that follows, you have every other day an African man is stabbed or shot, or another anti-African rally. And then May 23, 2012, you have full-scale anti-African pogrom in Tel Aviv. Here, this woman designed a personalized t-shirt, tank top, saying, Mavet la Sudanim, death to the Sudanese. And of course, again, Mikhail Ben-Ari comes up to the mic and incites racism and riles people up and gets them going. But he wasn't the only one. There were several members of Knesset from the ruling Likud party who got up there and just drove people over the edge, inciting crazy racism against Africans, including Miri Regev, who called Africans cancer. And hearing this, it just sent people into just over the edge, and you had 1,000 Israelis running rampant through the streets of Tel Aviv, attacking any dark-skinned person they came across, stopping buses. Hey, do you have any African people in here? Get them out. Let's get them. Smashing any vehicle that had African people in it. This woman, they bashed her over the head with a beer bottle and threw her child to the ground. And of course, any cafe or restaurant operated by African people smashed and looted. And so you'd think that after this orgy of violence, that after this outpouring of racism, people would have, taken stock of what had happened and looked at themselves in the mirror and said, how did we come to this point? And, we breathe deeply. We need to reflect and how we can prevent this from happening again. Forget about it. If anything, the racism just redoubled. And in the days that followed, you just have this insane scene of African people marching to the UN offices in Tel Aviv saying, we need protection, help, we're being attacked in the streets. And we're humans, we're not cancer, we're humans. I'm hard-pressed to think of some other situation where people have to assert that they are in fact human beings and not a cancer. And this wasn't a marginal statement. In the days that followed, a poll by the Israel Democracy Institute found that over half of Israeli Jews agreed with that statement that touched off the race riot. That 52% agreed Africans are cancer. And 33%, a third of Israeli Jews, supported the vigilante violent attacks on Africans that night. In the same week that followed the race riot, you have rabbis in Bnei Brak issuing a new religious edict calling Israelis who are in solidarity with Africans, Rodef. Now, what does that mean? You may recall in 1995, the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, was assassinated. He was assassinated by a Jewish Israeli, right? And he did so because racist rabbis issued a similar edict calling Rabin a Rodef, saying, he is evil, he deserves to die. If anyone out there assassinates him, there's no punishment for that. You get off scot-free. And so some Israeli Jew went out and killed Rabin on the basis of this religious edict. And so now you have rabbis issuing the same edict of Rodef to apply to any Israeli that's in solidarity with African asylum seekers. In the weeks that followed, you had ambassadors from 6 African nations appeal to the foreign ministry, please put a stop to this. Stop inciting racist violence against Africans. We can't walk out in the street. We're not safe. Our wives can't go shopping. We can't leave our homes without being accosted. The deportations begin in the summer of 2012. So the first group to go are the South Sudanese. You may recall that at this point, a new nation is formed. Sudan and South Sudan separate. And the government says, now you've got your own country to go back to. You can leave. You must leave. And people were pleading, please just let us stay a little while longer. It's not safe. But the government, of course, was insistent. And they had to go back, even though, half the people in South Sudan didn't even have access to clean drinking water at this point. And sure enough, within 10 days of the first group of deportees getting back to South Sudan, they started dropping like flies. Kids dying of diseases that easily could have been treated in any Israeli hospital. But now they're back in South Sudan without any kind of infrastructure. They were dying. These kids who, born in Israel, spoke perfect Hebrew, but as far as Israel was concerned, they were foreigners and deserved to be deported. Now, remember that African kindergarten that was firebombed I told you about? So by the end of the year, by December, in the same month, Israel deported back to Africa the man who'd opened up this kindergarten, providing a safe space for refugee kids. And in the very same month, they exonerated the man. Well, I shouldn't say exonerated. He got a couple months of community service, but didn't serve a day in jail the man who firebombed that African kindergarten, if you can imagine that. So December 2012, up until this point, there isn't any serious physical barrier between Egypt and Israel. There's a vast desert, but now the government wants to end this migration of African asylum seekers, so it spends billions of shekels and builds this fence along the border. And it completes the fence in December 2012. And so Benjamin Netanyahu comes out there and examines the fence and, you know, praises those who built it and is proud to announce that now we have ended the African migration to Israel. There's no more Africans entering the country. And now we're going to enter stage two, which is kicking out all the Africans that are already in the country, those 60,000 that managed to immigrate in that time, up until that point. And while he didn't mention it, I should also point out that many of those men who worked welding the fence, putting it up, were themselves African. Without many economic opportunities, they were forced to take whatever job was available. In December 2012, New Year's Eve, there's a headline in Israeli newspapers, 80-year-old Israeli woman raped by African man. And of course, the news of this just drives people insanely angry, you know? And people are incensed that a Jewish woman has been defiled by a non-Jewish man. You know, and they're out in the streets again demanding that all Africans be deported immediately because of the action, or maybe action, you know, I don't know about innocent till presumed guilty, but here someone's been accused of a crime, and on the basis of that, the people are baying for blood and demanding that all Africans be deported from the country. Now, it was interesting because this event happened exactly 100 years after this other seminal event. You may have heard of the story of Leo Frank. So this man, he owned a factory in the United States, and a young girl who worked in that factory was raped and murdered. And he was accused of the crime, and he was brought to trial. We don't know, did he do it or didn't he? We won't know, because before the court passed sentence, people broke into his jail cell and lynched him because he was Jewish. And this idea that the white race was defiled by a Jewish man, potentially, just drove people over the edge. And because of that event, the ADL was formed. The Anti-Defamation League was founded in 1913 because of the case of Leo Frank, to prevent this from happening again, this mob violence, this intense, you know, these racist hatred campaigns directed towards minority communities. You know, and that's why this group was supposedly established. But today, it's no longer an anti-hate group. It's a hate group. Because here, in 2013, last year, in the entire year of its centennial, the Anti-Defamation League did not issue even a single condemnation or word of criticism for the Israeli government because of its war on African asylum seekers. They didn't have a single word to say the entire year. And it wasn't only Abe Foxman. It was pretty much across the board. You know, with the exception of Jewish Voice for Peace, maybe, there wasn't any major mainstream Jewish organization who stood up and criticized and demanded an end to Israel's war on Africans. And it really stands out in stark contrast to these groups' positions on immigration to America, because consistently, Jewish groups are the loudest in their vocal support for immigration reform to this continent, and strong advocates for a leniency towards undocumented Americans, you know? But in here in North America, it plays out to their advantage because Jews are in the minority. So increased tolerance, multicultural society is good for Jewish people. It protects them. But in Israel, they don't need that protection because ethnically, Jews are the largest group in Israel. They're in the majority, so they don't need minority rights to be respected. So these groups are silently supporting Israel's war on African asylum seekers. And what is this demographic threat they're so afraid of? Even if you count all the African asylum seekers in the country, they only amount to 0.7% of the population. And so now we're at the beginning of 2013, and there are once again national elections. Netanyahu runs for the prime ministership once more, and now he's campaigning on the basis of his war on Africans. So you have this campaign poster, Atzirat Gal HaMistananim MiSinai, we stop this wave of infiltrators from the Sinai. vote for the Likud party. And there's so much political currency to be made from anti-African racism that, sure, he comes back to power as prime minister, but it's not only on the national level, even on the local level. So imagine, if you would, walking down the streets and being confronted with a poster such as this: "To keep those Jews far from my daughter, I'm voting Christian identity for city council." I hope this never exists. This is completely fictitious. I made this in Photoshop, okay? But this does exist in real life. In Khadera, there is a poster that says exactly the same thing, but directed towards Africans, not Jews. And I should point out that this party, who ran on the basis of this platform, they got into power, okay? And it's not only in small towns or little villages. Even in the supposed liberal bubble of Tel Aviv, you know, I couldn't walk 30, 40 meters outside my apartment without being confronted with this poster. And again, I've translated it into English for your benefit. God hates lust. Christians don't date Jews. Christians date Christians. Jews go home. This is what I have to see when I walk outside my apartment. Of course, it's directed to non-Jews in the Hebrew version. And so after years of covering this issue, I'm just soaking up all this negative energy and this hate, and it's just too much. And I need to take a break. I just need a safe space. And so I decide to move out of the population centers in Jerusalem here, in Tel Aviv here, this graffiti, kick out the N-word. So I move away from Tel Aviv, and I moved down to Dimona. And the reason why I moved there, in a small town in the desert, is because that I'd heard that there's actually a population of Africans that had been living there for decades. And surely, if they had been there for all this time, Israelis must have gotten used to their presence and gotten over this racist hatred. So I moved down to Dimona. It's actually a group of African Americans who, from Detroit and D.C. and Chicago, moved out to Israel in the late 60s and 70s. And their story is kind of interesting. They, you know, at the same time as the civil rights era, and you have black people turning to the Black Panthers and some joining the Nation of Islam. And so there were African Americans who also embraced Judaism or the Torah and the Old Testament, and, you know, forged a Afrocentric form of Hebraic practice, and felt affinity for the land of the Bible, felt that their communal story lines up with the mythology of the Israelites of the Bible, and so saw themselves in that story and wanted to reinvent themselves and move. They were kind of like African Zionists in a way, and they got up and they moved to Israel. And so they had been living in Dimona for decades, and that's why I moved there in January 2013. And I'm very happy I made that transition, and I've really enjoyed this last year that I've spent in Dimona. It's awesome walking around, and, you know, everyone's wearing dashikis, and it's like it's pretty trippy. It's a great place. I really enjoy walking around, seeing black people actually with their head. You probably will think this is so strange, but just to see African men and women walking around with their heads up and not casting their eyes down every time they pass by a light-skinned person is a relief. And so I really enjoyed this time, but I was dead wrong about thinking that Israelis had gotten over their racism because they were living in proximity to Africans for decades. So here, again, I can't walk 2 minutes from my apartment in Dimona without being confronted with this graffiti: "We hate the N-word." And so I realized, I mean, that actually many people in the community were just as stateless as these African refugees who had arrived. So here's my friend Dalia, okay? Born in Israel, speaks fluent Hebrew, her partner's Israeli, they have a child together, yet she is just as stateless. She has no papers, she has no documents, she's not allowed to work, okay, legally. She has no access to health care. Or what if her baby gets sick? She can't go to a doctor, she can't go to a hospital, she's got nothing, all right? And she's lived there her whole life. And the only reason she has no rights is because she's not Jew, not a blood Jew, you know? And there's hundreds of people just like her who've born in Israel, live in Israel their whole lives, and are in the same status. And so I went into the government archives and I started researching. And going back decades, I realized that this war on Africans was not new in any sense. It's only now that there's, you know, 55,000 Africans in the country. But even when there was only 1,500 Africans in the country, the government was determined as ever to drive them all out. So in 2012, you have Miri Regev, as I said, declaring that Africans are cancer, slagging them. But even as far back as 1980, you have member of Knesset Dov Shilansky, later on the Speaker of the Knesset, saying that all the Africans should be put on a boat out at sea, and people calling to drown the boat, drown them all at sea. And in 2012, you have Knesset researcher preparing an official Knesset report, which went to official police statistics, found that Africans consistently have lower crime rates than native Israelis. And because his report exonerated them, the Israeli government tanked the report, pulled it offline, and demoted him from his position. The same thing happened in the late 70s with David Glass, member of Knesset, preparing this report on the African Hebrews and noting that police statistics showed they had lower crime rates than Israelis. Yet he was dismissed from the party and his report was never followed up on and shelved. And just as today, you have the vast majority of Israelis calling for all Africans to be kicked out. Okay, 61% want them all deported from the country, 18%+ wanting them all jailed. So that's 80% of the Israeli Jewish population demanding that all African asylum seekers are rounded up out of Israeli cities. And back in the day, early 70s, same thing. Polls showed that most Israelis wanted the government to kick all the Africans out. Now you have the mayor of the city with the largest concentration of Africans, the mayor of Tel Aviv, demanding that the government kick them all out of the country. Back in the day, same thing. Mayor of the city with the largest concentration of Africans, then it was Dimona, demanding the government kick them all out. But nowadays, the mayor doesn't only talk about it, isn't only demanding it, he's doing it too. He's sending his municipal inspectors to do their part, sending them into African restaurants to pour bleach into the cooking pots of the African restaurants so that there's no possible way that they could make a living. And last year, even the US State Department issued a report calling Israel's treatment of African asylum seekers a most significant human rights problem. But once again, the government completely ignores the report. And with Netanyahu re-elected to power in the new government, he appoints that very same woman who called Africans cancer, who incited the race riot. He appoints her to head the Interior Committee, the very committee that determines the fate of African asylum seekers. Now, I should be fair to Miri Regev. She did apologize for calling Africans cancer, but she didn't apologize to the Africans. She apologized to Israeli cancer victims for comparing them to Africans. And the government in March 2013 issues a report, the Sofer report, which puts together a policy for the government how to treat asylum seekers. And among the findings of this report is that those Israelis who advocate for Africans are labeled anti-Semites and potential terrorists. Premier terrorist, I guess, this Jewish booby here in the bottom right-hand corner. Clearly a grave threat that you wouldn't want to encounter in a dark alley somewhere. Now, because no one's doing anything, and the Israeli government is passing measure after measure, and there's no objections, seemingly, from the world, from the international community. So it realizes it can do whatever it wants to, and it begins to outright deport African asylum seekers back to the countries they fled from. Now, I don't know if it was fate or coincidence or whether it was intentional, but the day that they began the deportations, July 15th, was exactly 75 years to the day after the Evian Conference. If you haven't heard of the Evian Conference, on the very eve of World War II, when it was already quite clear what the Nazis intended to do to the Jews, here the United States and the UK and other countries all met in Evian in France, and they convened to decide, well, maybe if you take in some Jewish refugees, and maybe if we take in, and maybe if they take in, then maybe we can save these people from being butchered. And in the end, none of these countries wanted to take in any Jews because they were Jews. And in the end, on the same day, 75 years later, Israel begins deporting these Africans because they're not Jews. Once Israel does this, then according to the UN representative to Israel, Mickey Bavli, he calls that the gravest violation possible of the Refugee Convention that Israel has signed, a crime never before committed. Now, September 2013, you know, a year and 8 months after the government passes the anti-infiltration law, the Supreme Court says, this is an egregious violation of human rights. You unanimously, by a decision of 9-0, all Supreme Court justices overruled the law, call it unconstitutional, and demand that the government release all African asylum seekers from Israeli jails within 3 months. Right after that, the Attorney General announces to the police officers, continue arresting Africans, ignore the Supreme Court decision. The government simply initiates a new law, identical to the old law in every way, but even worse than the first. So now, instead of arresting Africans and jailing them for 3 years in order to make their lives miserable, under the new provision, they can be held indefinitely, infinite amount of time, for life, potentially, until they choose to self-deport. And so at this point, African people realize there's nowhere to go. Their backs are up against the wall, and they have only themselves to count on. They can't wait for some Supreme Court to rule in their favor. The government will ignore it in any case. And so people come together, and this is no easy feat, because these Africans are from different countries, and they speak different languages, and they're from different ethnic groups. But amazingly, they did. Here, Tel Aviv City Hall, 25,000, 30,000 people protesting, demanding their refugee rights, trying to appeal to the government and to the Israeli population, saying, we're not asking for much. We're just asking that you follow the letter of the law. You signed on to these international agreements. You co-authored this refugee convention. Abide by it. Just examine our applications openly and transparently, as you were required to, or else extract yourself from these conventions if you don't mean to abide by them. But if you do want to remain a member in good standing of the international community, then examine our refugee requests. For those who aren't, they'll have to go. But for those who are refugees, we deserve our rights. And so you have people protesting in front of the American embassy and in front of the Canadian embassy, in front of the UN, in front of the AU, really teaching Israelis a lesson in democracy, whether it's in front of the Knesset here or the Prime Minister's office, and really trying every non-violent tactic that they can think of, if it's a sit-in or a sleep-in or a teach-in or a... It's really inspiring on one hand to hear, like you heard when you were first filing in and I played that video and you could hear people chanting, we want freedom, no more prisons, and to be surrounded by throngs of thousands of people just demanding their human rights. It's incredibly inspiring, and at the same time it's incredibly depressing, because no matter how much they protest, the government just outright rejects their demands and says, we don't care, you can protest as much as you want, you can strike as much as you want, we're going to continue rounding you into these camps and until you agree to self-deport. And the population, as you saw, firmly backs the government's position. So it seems like there's no hope of any internal force breaking this vice grip on the African asylum seekers. And what are these desert detention centers that the government is rounding people into? It's funny, because at the beginning, Israeli people, like most people in the world, want to have a positive self-image. They want to think of themselves as good people. So they couldn't allow themselves to imagine that this was a horrible place. So the government pitched this to the population as some kind of country club, with recreational facilities and with educational facilities. You wanted to go there. It sounded so good the way they made it sound. Of course, it's horrible, as you can imagine. It's in the middle of the desert, on the border with Egypt. It's surrounded by nothing except a firing range. They've got nowhere to go and nothing to do. They're crammed into these trailers with no heating in the middle of the winter. There's no insulation, nothing. They don't even have hot water half the time. Food, if you can call it that. Often they miss meals. I don't know what this pink goop is supposed to be. It's certainly not food by any stretch of the imagination. No nutritional content. No fruits, no vegetables, nothing. No educational, no recreational. There aren't even medical services there. How negligent can you get? A country that supposedly can send, delegations to Haiti and to all these other places in the world where they suffer from natural disasters, it can't even a murderers and rapists deserve medical attention. Here, they don't even provide medical attention. NGOs like Physicians for Human Rights have to come in on the weekends and open up clinics on the ground outside these detention centers. That's how pathetic it is there. And probably the most insulting aspect of all is this sign that they put up. The Office of Employment. Employment for the society. I couldn't imagine a more Orwellian sign at the entrance to a detention center. This is the only thing they've left for us to be reminded of. You know, Arbeit macht frei, the entrance to Auschwitz. Now, are you offended that I would make such a comparison, that I would dare compare these detention centers to concentration camps? Well, you damn well should be offended, and you should direct your anger and your rage to the Israeli government, who isn't even embarrassed to use these words. They know no one's looking, they know no one cares, so even in that official government report that I described earlier, released in March 2013, look it up yourself, it's online, in the Hebrew, I've translated here for your benefit, it calls for the concentration of Africans. Open up any Hebrew-English dictionary in the world, and you will find that the word rikuz is translated as concentration, and a machane rikuz is a concentration camp, okay? Now, don't get it twisted. I didn't say death camp. I don't think there's any firing squads or crematoria or gas chambers or anything like that. Nothing like that. But it is a concentration camp, okay? A concentration camp is a place where people are forced to live under harsh conditions because of their political opinions or because of their ethnic affiliation. And that's what's happening to these Africans because they're non-white, non-Jews, and no other reason. Concentration camps existed long before Nazi Germany. United States opened up and rounded Cherokee Indians into concentration camps as far back as the 1830s, and many nations since then. And after World War II, many countries opened up concentration camps. Sadly, many countries have done this well before and well after World War II, okay? And that is what's happening today in Israel. Even the president of Eritrea, this despicable man who's responsible for thousands of his own countrymen fleeing every month, even he has called these detention centers concentration camps. And frankly, he's not the only president to do so, because this man, Reuven Rivlin, member of Knesset, former speaker of the Knesset, and currently the leading candidate to be the next president of Israel, publicly called these detention centers concentration camps. Okay? So take it up with them if you're offended. And all you need to do is speak Hebrew. Okay? Anyone who speaks fluent Hebrew can go online any day of the week and just read an average news report. Here, this occurred a week before I came on this speaking tour. Channel 10 News reports an Israeli man attacks an African man in Tel Aviv for no reason. That's the news report. The responses, this is the kinds of responses that people give in their own names, connected to their own personal Facebook accounts. No sense of shame whatsoever. Too bad they didn't tear him to pieces, the disgusting blackie. They should get the hell out, those contaminants. All they brought was diseases and pollution. Go home already, you garbage. And as I said, if you think it's bad the way people speak about Africans, you have to hear what they say to those few Israelis who stand in solidarity with them. So that man who started up Marak Levinsky, that soup kitchen for African asylum seekers, this is what people write on his Facebook page. They need to turn that center I'm paying for into gas chambers. They need to bring snipers to shoot all these monkeys. And that's to the men. You don't even want to hear what they say to the Israeli women who stand up for the human rights of Africans. And this is probably the sickest example that I can think of. And there's many. Sadly. But this one is the grossest, probably. This envelope, this is a piece of junk mail that Israelis received in the mail in late 2012. I've, again, translated it into English so you can see. The solution to the problem of the infiltrators is what it says on the outside of the envelope. So the average Israeli picks this up from their post office box and they see, oh, this is someone proposing what to do about these African asylum seekers. And they open it up and they find an advertisement for insect extermination. Now, this company isn't trying to convince Israelis to compare Africans to insects that deserve to be exterminated. It's actually worse than that. It's far more insidious. It's that this company assumes that you already think that, assumes that you already conceive of African asylum seekers as equivalent to insects that enter your home and must be exterminated. It's counting on you to find that comparison funny. Not be offended by it, but to find it funny. And on the basis of this chuckle that it elicits from you, to call them up and secure their services. That's how sick it gets. That's the level of discourse in Israel around non-white, non-Jewish people. And I don't need to tell you how in the lead up to World War II, you had this anti-Jewish propaganda comparing Jews to vermin, to insects, spreading this idea that they are disease bearers and therefore dehumanizing them to the point where anything was possible. Of course, again, it's not only about Nazi Germany. In the United States, at the same time, you had the United States government putting out this propaganda, vilifying Japanese people as deserving of death, comparing them to rats. But that's the level of hate, saying these people are deserving of being murdered. And why is it that when journalist Max Blumenthal puts out his book Goliath just a few months ago, and he describes these scenes taking place in Israel, and he calls the chapter titles the concentration camp to describe the detention centers, and calling the anti-African riot, calling it the night of the broken glass, evoking Kristallnacht on the eve of the Holocaust. So why is it that when he makes these comparisons that American Jewish intellectuals are vociferous in their attack on Max? You know, how dare he make this comparison? Yet these so-called intellectuals have not one word of criticism about the actual events described in the book. They've got nothing to say about the government's war on Africans. January 2014, African family standing in downtown Tel Aviv, woman holding her child, her one-year-old baby in her arms. An Israeli man walks up and stabs the baby in the head 3 times. Of course, within minutes, the police were quickly issuing press reports. No, this was not related to racism in any way. This man was just crazy and, you know, drunk. And please, of course, it was a white man who perpetrated the crime and a black victim. So, of course, there was no racism involved. Oh, he must have been crazy. Where have I heard that one before? Well, in the weeks that followed, sure enough, this man's confessions were released to the media. And then we saw for ourselves what he had to say. Why did you attack this baby? I tried to kill her because I hate them. They're black. A black baby. Blacks in general are terrorists. Did the daughter of a whore die? Now, I don't mean for a second to suggest that this is across the board, that all Israelis can be compared to this man. Clearly, anyone who stabs a one-year-old baby is psychotic and can't be compared to, you know, the masses. But why did he stab a black baby? Because for months and for years, the Israeli government has been inciting racial hatred towards Africans. How long does this have to go on for? How many more black babies? What can we take from this? The people who want to kick out these kids because they're not Jewish are morally no different from the people who wanted to kick out these kids because they were Jewish. And the only moral lesson that we can take from the Holocaust is not never again just for us. It has to be never again for anyone. And if there's one final thought I want to leave you with before I conclude my words, it's that just now, as I'm touring across North America, trying to inform people of what's going on in Israel, the Israeli government is sending, Netanyahu himself is in the United States, and they're sending other emissaries and people to put out these messages to counter the truth, to try to portray Palestinians as intransigent and convince the entire world that they, the Palestinians and all the Arabs and the Martians and the Venusians and the Alpha Centauris and the whole universe must accept Israel's self-definition as the Jewish state, okay? It's saying that you must accept this as a condition for a peace deal, that Israel must be acknowledged to be the Jewish state. Well, this is what that looks like, okay? And this is before you get the blank check. Imagine if the world signs off on this blank check and lets Israel self-define as a Jewish state and acknowledges that it's a Jewish state. Imagine what it's capable of. If this is what it can do without that, imagine what it'll do to the non-Jewish people who live there once you give it a blank check to do as it will. So, unfortunately, I don't have any happy story to conclude with, to end it on a cheerful note. But I just want to implore you to, at your leisure, go onto my website, read these articles, watch the videos. I have over 100 resources on this topic. The mainstream media is censoring it. It doesn't want people to know what's happening. Go there, find out for yourselves, and spread this only through citizens' networks and your social circles, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, can we spread the word. And only then can we hope to perhaps create some kind of consensus or some kind of pressure from the international community to end this ethnic cleansing. That's it.